Hello there. Today is Monday, February 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the primary race for the Democrats seeking to make Trump a one-term president begins today. The first death from the coronavirus outside of China.
However, the condition of the patient deteriorated within the last 24 hours.
Also ahead, singer Ariana Grande sets an all-time record for a female artist. It's all on today's International Edition. The first votes of the 2020 U.S. presidential election will be cast today when the state of Iowa holds its first in the national caucuses. For the last 50 years, America's political parties have used a series of caucuses and primary elections to determine their presidential nominee. VOA's Steve Reddish explains the process.
Imagine holding more than 1,000 meetings all on the same day at the same time. That's what it's like to hold a caucus in a state such as Iowa. Every voting precinct in the state of Iowa has a designated meeting place, such as schools and libraries. On caucus day, people go to those meetings to discuss and declare publicly and openly their support for a particular presidential candidate. The results are tabulated, and delegates are awarded to the candidates according to party rules. Political parties in six states will hold a caucus in 2020: Iowa, Nevada, Kentucky, Hawaii, North Dakota, and Wyoming. Most well known is the Iowa caucus. Since 1972, Iowa has been the nation's first caucus. Its results are dissected, providing the first tangible evidence of support for any of the candidates.
There's no question I've got competitors with a near home field advantage.
Iowa's 2020 caucus will be held on the evening of February 3rd. The focus is on the Democrats because U.S. President Donald Trump, with token opposition, is almost assured the Republican nomination at the party's August convention. Unlike the open nature of a caucus, voting in a primary election is private and done in a voting booth. The votes are tabulated and delegates are awarded to candidates according to party rules. More than 40 states will hold a primary election in 2020. New Hampshire state law mandates it hold the nation's first primary. This year, it takes place on February 11th. Because they are the first to cast votes, Iowa and New Hampshire attract more attention than more populous, more diverse states with more delegates at stake. A criticism of the current system is that Iowa and New Hampshire are overwhelmingly white. Presidential hopefuls spend months commuting between the two states, visiting restaurants, state fairs, and town hall meetings in an effort to meet as many voters as possible. For the candidates who survive Iowa and New Hampshire, their next big test is March 3rd, 2020, known as Super Tuesday because of the number of states that hold primaries on that day, 14. Among them, America's two most populous states, California and Texas. About 30% of the delegates for each party's convention are at stake on Super Tuesday. Primary elections continue through the first week of June. Usually, one candidate clinches the nomination earlier than that, making the party convention in the summer a crowning moment, along with the naming of the candidate's choice of a vice president. But if no candidate clinches the nomination during the caucuses and primaries, a contested convention would produce a summer political drama. Steve Reddish, VOA News.
Well, with the final countdown to the caucuses now underway, the Democratic candidates are making their closing arguments in earnest around the state. Public opinion polls show a close race among the top of the 11 contenders vying to challenge Republican President Donald Trump in November. Joining us from the state of Iowa is VOA's Kane Farabach. Kane, thanks for being with us. You're there in the thick of it. What's the latest on the ground?
By any measurement, it's a very close race among really the top four or five contenders here, and that's not only U.S. Senator from Vermont, Bernie Sanders, that's also the U.S. Senator from Minnesota, Amy Klobuchar, also former Vice President Joe Biden, it's also former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg, and it's also Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. All of them are really vying for that turnout on caucus night. And because the polls show that all of these candidates are so very close, turnout will be key in order to essentially help them win the caucus meeting room that their supporters are going to show up at to profess their support for their candidacies. And so that's the effort right now here in Iowa. It's making sure that they're getting out, meeting as many voters as they possibly can, and making sure that they have a good, sizable presence at these meeting or caucus locations throughout the state.
And, you know, the last minute pitch, several of the candidates have been back and forth to Washington due to the impeachment. That, of course, continues. How detrimental does it seem that some of these people will be back and forth and have been back and forth?
It's a real issue because these top contenders are senators that have to deal with this impeachment trial. So they are losing valuable time on the ground here in Iowa, being able to personally connect with the voters and to personally be on the ground, getting the message out that they need that support on the caucus night, and being in front of television cameras that are all here to cover what's happening here in Iowa. So it is to them a somewhat of a detriment. However, they have surrogates here on the ground or people who are campaigning for them to spread that message. But here in Iowa, everybody's used to seeing the candidates themselves. So sometimes voters want to be able to personally interact with the candidate themselves and will make a decision based on who they're going to support as to whether or not they've, you know, been able to have that personal contact or has the message directly resonating from the candidate to them. So not being here is a potential liability for them heading into caucus night, but, you know, they're all here on the ground trying to get from location to location to reach as many people as they can while they're here this weekend.
And there are two differing views that we've been hearing about the importance of the Iowa caucuses. We've been hearing it's the first vote for the primary season to determine who will be the Democratic nominee. A lot of people think that this is sort of, this gives an indication of who could potentially be doing well going forward, or on the other hand, will at least get a big bump in the polls. But others say this isn't what it used to be. It doesn't represent the demographics of the nation anymore. Are you getting any sense of which of those could be more accurate and how important these are and how people there feel they are?
I think a lot of people here are very aware of the fact that Iowa is not the most diverse state in the country. And when it comes to participating in the caucus, only 15 to 16% of registered voters who might participate in the general election will turn out to participate in this caucus. So there is some credence to the criticism that this is not widely representative of the electorate. It's not how the election will look in the general election in the fall. But the real issue here, and it is something that is debated on the campaign trail, is electability. Who is the person that we're going to choose? And in this case, it's for Democrats because Donald Trump is the presumptive nominee for the Republicans since he's the incumbent president. So really the issue here is which Democrat in this field of candidates is going to be able to successfully challenge Donald Trump in November. That is probably one of the biggest issues here on the campaign trail for Democrats listening to these candidates. And so who they choose and who they caucus for, this is one of the issues that's probably foremost on their minds.
The person who wins the Iowa caucus, that obviously gives them momentum. Does it hurt the other people going forward?
Well, we should keep in mind that there are several candidates that are not even campaigning here in Iowa. Michael Bloomberg is one of them. He has a strategy that he's focusing on many of the important Super Tuesday states, which take place for the Super Tuesday primary on March 3rd, California being biggest among them, in which there'll be a lot of people who are coming out to vote in that election. So there are some people that aren't even paying attention to Iowa. That being said, the candidates that are here view this as a must-win. Even placing second and third may not be enough to keep some of these candidates in the race to move on and go to even New Hampshire next week. Typically, in the past, people that have not done well in the Iowa caucuses announce the end of their campaigns or suspension of their campaigns in the week after the results of the caucus come out. So for those on the ground here, it is important. It is very important for them to take away a win here.
All right, that's VOA's Kane Farabaugh reporting from Iowa, the first state of the presidential primary voting season. We will certainly be hearing more from you later as the caucus results come in. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Republican senators say Trump's Ukraine actions were wrong, but don't merit removal. London's police say a man shot dead by police has been shot dead by police after a stabbing incident. A new report finds that Al-Qaeda's branch is claiming the December U.S. Navy base shooting. And new technology could make the coronavirus vaccine in record time. find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. As the deadly coronavirus continues to spread worldwide, it has killed its first patient outside of China. News reports from the Philippines say a Chinese man from Wuhan in Hebei province, where the virus was first detected, died in a hospital in Manila a few days after arriving there. Many countries, including the United States, are denying entry to all foreign visitors who'd recently been to China as part of a global effort to stop the spread. And Americans returning home from China are also being quarantined. Sarah Bassett reports.
A 44-year-old Chinese man from Wuhan was admitted to hospital last month after experiencing flu-like symptoms. Philippines Health Secretary Francisco Duque III says the patient developed severe pneumonia.
The patient was stable and showed signs of improvement. However, the condition of the patient deteriorated within the last 24 hours, resulting in his demise.
Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte approved a temporary ban on all travelers, except Filipinos, from China and its autonomous regions. The US, Japan, Singapore, and Australia have imposed similar restrictions, despite criticism from China and an assessment from the World Health Organization that they were unnecessarily hurting trade and travel. I'm Sarah Bassett.
Well, meanwhile, for months now, thousands of people in Hong Kong who've been marching in protest, in many cases fighting against their local government and its relationship with the Chinese government in Beijing. Much of that now has apparently changed over the past few weeks as the coronavirus has taken hold of the headlines. VOA Asia's Ira Melman talks to Ren Xin, a correspondent for VOA's Mandarin service, asking how things have changed with the situation.
The impact is pretty obvious. We're not seeing any organized large-scale rallies or protests, I think, since January 19. So that was the global sanctions rally, which, of course, ended in clashes between the police and the protesters. So that was the last major protest we have seen. But that doesn't mean the protests are over. In fact, I mean, a lot of people are saying that it's just taking a different form because we're still seeing a lot of protests and the gatherings, which are some of them are focused on how the government is handling the virus, the Wuhan virus outbreak. This is considered a public health crisis because a lot of people in Hong Kong still remember 2003, the SARS epidemic, in which 299 people died in Hong Kong. So there's actually today I went to a protest. It's a community protest. People are protesting against the government's plan to open a quarantine facility in their community. So one thing they're saying is, first of all, the government did not consult with the local community before they made the plan. Second of all, they are very angry with the government because people in Hong Kong have been calling for the government to close all the border crossings between mainland China and Hong Kong. And also we are seeing a lot of people like lining up for surgical masks. So they're saying like even the government even are not doing a good job in just meet the basic demand of the people.
I have heard, and tell me if I'm wrong, that there was talk of a strike of healthcare workers?
Yes, yes. The healthcare workers union, they had a vote last night. So so most people voted for the strike. So today they demanded the chief executive to sit down and talk with them, but the chief executive said no. So most likely tomorrow, some of the healthcare workers will go on strike. So that's something, you know, we need to keep an eye on. You can sense the people are very angry with, you know, the government handling of this crisis. And also a lot of the protesters tell me that this crisis or the outbreak kind of brought together the blue camp and the yellow camp. Because in Hong Kong, the yellow camp means the pro-democracy anti-government protesters or people who support the protests, and the blue camp means people who are pro-government, pro-police. So when they go on the street, like to protest against this government plan or the quarantine facility, so you can tell it's people from the local community, and some of them are not in support with of the democracy protest. So people are saying like, hey, it doesn't matter whether you're yellow or blue, so we're all like green. You put blue and yellow together, So it's very interesting. It's a very interesting development because a lot of people from the pro-government citizens are now also dissatisfied with how the government handled this crisis.
What about foreigners who went in Hong Kong? Can they get out? Are they getting out? What's the situation?
Oh, the situation is, I don't have a lot of statistics, but what I heard is some airlines are canceling their flights because pilots who refuse to fly to Hong Kong. So that means there's no returning flight. So people who want to get out of Hong Kong, say like going to the United States on a certain airline, but there's no returning flight. So they are stuck here. But of course, you can go with another airline. You just have to be, if you can get out of Hong Kong, just do it early. So we don't know what the situation will be like in a few days.
All right. That's Ren Xin, correspondent for VOA's Mandarin Service, speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. Official negotiations haven't begun yet over their future relationship, but tensions are building between Britain and the European Union following Britain's official exit from the bloc on Friday. Brussels says Britain will have to commit to aligning with EU standards in order to get a free trade deal, but London has insisted it will not do so. As Henry Ridgewell reports, official talks are not due to get underway for at least another month, leaving precious little time to negotiate a new deal.
On a clear day, the white cliffs of Dover are visible from France. The geography has not changed. But in many senses, the distance between Britain and its continental neighbours widened overnight Friday. Britain is now out of the European Union. But after 3.5 years of political chaos, many Britons appear to have Brexit fatigue.
I'm not going to lie, I didn't want to leave. I voted Remain. But we are where we are. And I just hope that, there are no disasters, I guess.
A Brexit countdown clock was projected onto the Dover Cliffs Friday night and also onto Prime Minister Boris Johnson's residence at 10 Downing Street. Pro-Brexit supporters staged celebrations in central London.
We should celebrate the fact that freed from the constraints of the European Union, we once again will be able to find our place in the world.
Finding that place may not be so simple. Britain is now in a transition period and has given itself just 11 months to negotiate a free trade deal with Europe. That will come to an end in December when a new so-called cliff-edge Brexit looms.
Many people believe that Brexit, having gone through 3.5 years of debate about what kind of Brexit to have and whether to have it, it's all sorted, it's all done. It isn't done at all. In fact, the actual dimensions of the new relationship between the UK and the EU is just starting.
Early indications suggest Europe will demand access to British fishing waters and guarantees that Britain won't undercut the EU's labour and environmental standards in return for access to the EU single market. Britain has ruled out such close alignment.
We're not going to have high alignment with the EU, legislative alignment with their rules, but we'll want to cooperate, and we expect the EU to follow through on their commitment to a Canada-style free trade agreement.
But that hard line is putting Britain itself under increasing strain, with Scotland demanding a vote on independence so it can try to rejoin the EU. And across Britain, the divisions wrought by Brexit will not be easily healed. The White Cliffs of Dover have become a canvas for pro- and anti-EU messages beamed out towards the European mainland. Tensions are already building with what looks likely to be a stormy year ahead. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Well, according to the UN, about 152 million children between the ages of 5 and 17 are engaged in child labor. 73 million of them are in Africa. The UN has called for the end of child labor worldwide by 2025. It's an ambitious goal for the continent with for the highest rate of child labor in the world. VOA's Jesus Men-Oni takes a deeper look at the issue and the fight to restore the childhoods of millions across Africa.
Grueling work for little pay. That's the daily reality for millions of children across Africa. The International Labor Organization estimates about 73 million children in Africa are sent out to work because of widespread poverty, insufficient access to education, and conflict, some as young as 5 years old.
What we're talking about is work that puts their future in jeopardy, whether because their health is on the line, they're working in mines, for example, where the imminent danger of a mine collapse or death.
Mutada Haig left school in Sudan when he was 12. For him, it was a choice between studying or feeding his family.
My mother kept telling me, in the future, and when our life gets better and not get worse, I'll study and become a doctor. But all of a sudden, the whole situation occurred in Sudan.
According to the ILO, 85% of Africa's child laborers work in agriculture. Across all sectors, many are subject to back-breaking labor, long hours, and exposure to dangerous environments. Rights advocates say injuries are not the only problem.
There are other negative aspects because the children's self-esteem is low, because all the time he faces insults or has a low self-esteem, because all the time the factory's owner insults him, makes him feel that he is less than anyone. So you are already bringing up a generation that has no self-confidence.
Experts say putting kids to work is no solution to extreme poverty.
They don't have the opportunity to get an education and learn those skills that would enable them to get a decent job and become productive workers when they're older.
Several African governments, including Ivory Coast, Mali, Rwanda, and Nigeria, have taken steps to address the worst form of child labor, but it's not enough.
Poverty and illiteracy and cultural belief, religious prejudices, these are some of the reasons that has actually affected, the efficacy.
Major U.S. companies, including Apple, Google, Hershey's, and Nestle USA, have come under fire for allegedly failing to combat child labor in their supply chains. The companies say they're committed to responsible sourcing that prohibits the use of child labor. The UN's goal is to end child labor by 2025, an ambitious goal for a continent with the highest rates of child labor in the world. Jesus Semeoni, VOA News, Washington.
And you're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
On Our Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices
with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, it is not for everyone, but if your idea of fun involves taking a plunge in icy water, this may be your kind of event. That's exactly what some people did in Annapolis, Maryland, for a fundraiser for the Special Olympics of Maryland. Participants raised money for the sports organization for people with intellectual disabilities. VOA's Deborah Block takes us to the Polar Bear Plunge.
The freezing cold waters at Sandy Point State Park in Annapolis, Maryland, didn't deter these people from taking a plunge into the Chesapeake Bay.
We said, if we're going to do this, we need to make sure that people know who we are.
True.
And what better way to do it than a bunch of guys in bikini tops and boots skirts?
This is the world's largest winter polar bear plunge, where for 3 days this year, about 12,000 people ran into the bay. Some held flags supporting Maryland's professional football team, the Baltimore Ravens. The air temperature was a chilly 10 degrees Celsius, but the water was just a frigid 5 degrees.
The air is cold, but it's nothing compared to the water. The water, when you dive in, it's like a shock to your system.
The Worldwide Special Olympics is in 175 countries and gives people with intellectual disabilities the opportunity to compete in different sports.
The oldest athlete here in Maryland is 85 years old. They start competing when they're 8. We have some athletes who compete at a really high level, but you know what? The key is for every athlete to achieve their personal best.
This Special Olympics athlete got into the icy water.
When I went into the water, my legs started being cold, and then my body, actually, it was worth every minute of it.
Father and daughter held on to each other.
I couldn't move my face at all.
I'm a little crazy, but you know, it's all for a good cause. It supports Special Olympics, and we have family that's in Special Olympics, so it's a little tiny bit that I can do to help out.
People on the beach wait their turn. Many are first timers.
I hate cold water, so I'm excited, but yeah, definitely nervous.
It's my birthday today, and I don't really know why I did it.
This participant has taken the plunge 4 times since the yearly event started about 25 years ago.
We love it. It's become a family tradition. I've always been a huge supporter of Special Olympics, and this is just one more way of showing our support and gratitude.
Chris Stone says the Special Olympics changed his life.
When I didn't do Special Olympics, I didn't have anybody in my life. I had like 3 to 4 friends, but then when I got through Special Olympics, I made so many more friends, and that's why I enjoy it.
Those brave enough to dip into the waters raised more than $3 million for the Maryland Special Olympics this year. More money, they hope, will change more lives. Deborah Block, VOA News, Annapolis, Maryland.
Ariana Grande is breaking records on Spotify. She has become the first female singer to get 3.5 billion streams on 3 separate albums. Those include My Everything, Dangerous Woman, and Thank You, Next. The feat was first shared on Twitter by Chart Data.
One taught me patience and one taught me pain.
You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a fantastic day. Next, next, next.